Okay, this is the walking meditation. Dear Bhante, I wish to clarify if the method I have been practicing is incorrect or not regarding walking meditation. When I walk slower, I find it easy to focus on my steps clearly. And in my mind, I think of the heel of the right foot touching the ground. After I firmly touch the ground with the right foot, how the toes of the left foot lifts up simultaneously. For this long process, I walk slowly. I wish to find your comments on it, please. If you find it walking slowly helps you focus and you're aware of the touching of the feet, that's also fine. But like I said, also experiment. Walk at a normal pace and walk slightly faster and see what that does to your mindfulness, what it does to your energy. Because at different times, it does serves different purposes. Especially like I said, early in the morning or late at night, it's really good to walk a bit faster, just to rouse up energy, rouse up mindfulness. Yeah. Questions, comments? What is the difference or similarity between contemplation and thinking, please? I think it's contemplation is kind of a directed thought on a certain theme. Yeah, so let's say death contemplation, thinking about dying with this body. So you direct it, so let's say you visualize your own funeral. You're lying there, thinking what people will come, how many people will come, whether anybody will come to your funeral. visualizing the body breaking down slowly after a few days. And it's just the process, the physical process of the body breaking down. You can see that from Googling it or seeing the anatomy books, different things. As long as it keeps on this theme, otherwise you start thinking, oh, what my kids will think, oh, my kids are going to worry, or what happened to my house, do I have enough insurance for the house, this and the other stuff. Then it's veering towards different things. But as long as it's contemplation, it is sticking to the same theme, the body breaking down, the fact that you have to say goodbye to, leave everything behind. As long as it sticks to a certain theme, then that's contemplation. It starts to veer out to other kind of tangential stuff. Then it's just random thinking. So it is contemplation, it's using thinking, but towards a purpose, towards a goal, towards a theme. Yeah. So as long as it sticks with the theme, then it's contemplation, which is kind of going different directions. Then it's just kind of random thinking. And just bring it back to the theme, death and dying. And there are different ways to contemplate a certain theme. And just approach it, whatever ways that you find interesting, whatever ways that engages the mind, keeps it interesting. Yeah. Questions or comments?
Does that mean if you think about painting the house, is that contemplating?
Thinking about painting the house?
Paint the house?
Contemplating is usually about a theme of Dhamma.
Yeah.
And in Theravada, we're really like, I'm boring. It's like, OA, sickness and death. But not to be deceived by those kind of mundane themes, because once you when you think about them, you have a grasp on them, and you have some understanding. Those themes that may look a bit morbid or depressing actually brings a lot of sense of peace and happiness, because those are the truth of life. There's reality. We all have to go through these. OA, sickness and death, separation, what we love. It's not thinking about them. Then when these things happen, we suffer. So that's how you know that you should be paying more focus to contemplating the Dhamma or the themes of life. When you meet with loss, meet with sickness, and you get annoyed, you feel depressed, feel sad, then you think, oh, these things are something that I should focus on. Yeah? Questions, comments? Wonder what the significance is of the symbol of the fat Buddha. Yeah, I'm not sure either. But I think it's like, you know, when people make things, you know, statues, they just make it to sell, and they add bits and pieces to it that obviously doesn't, it starts to veer away from, you know, the real Buddha. Like, you know, like even the Theravada Buddha looks pretty traditional, but it's got this kind of fire come out of his head. I mean, he walks around with a fire on their head, right? But yeah, they add bits and pieces in there. It's supposed to represent wisdom. Yeah, Tibet Buddha, I think in the old days, you know, being skinny represents like not having good fortune. So being fat means, you know, kind of well-fed and you're happy. So it's supposed to represent like happiness and good fortune. And it sells. You know, skinny Buddha, ascetic Buddha didn't sell too well, I think. So you know, over time, you know, they decided, oh yeah, fat Buddha sells a lot, so we're just making less of fat Buddha. And it does. Every shop you see, there's a fat Buddha in there. Ajahn, can you please explain the etiquette of bowing? When it should be done, and is it considered okay for non-Buddhists to bow? Thank you. Yeah, bowing is just a form, a traditional form of paying respect, honoring. You know, bowing is a physical act of lowering yourself to something. You're saying something else is more higher, something you value above yourself. So you bow to the Buddha statue, but not strictly just a piece of plastic or bowing to idols. It's bowing to the qualities of the Buddha, right? Bowing to peace and compassion. So we usually bow three times. You can bow to peace, compassion, stillness, love, acceptance. Whatever you bow to is what you direct the mind towards. Yeah? And what you direct the mind towards, those things, those qualities grow. Yeah, so it's an act of humility, saying that, you know, these qualities are something that I value, something that I respect, something that I aspire to. Yeah. So we do bow to three bows, usually Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So Buddha, the teacher, the wise one, Dhamma is truth, saying that has something that you value, not just your views, your opinions, but truth, whatever that is. And Sangha, those are the communities of monks and nuns who practice, who realize something, who attain something from their practice. So you value that, the community of practitioners who dedicate their life to attaining liberation. Yeah, so that's, and I don't know how people feel, but it's optional. You do what you feel is comfortable. Yeah, so, you know, non-Buddhists can bow, but equally, non-Buddhists do not have to bow as well. Because respect is something from the heart. It's not something that, you know, you can force on somebody else. Questions or comments? Yes, Kelly? You're going to ask that. there is a correct bow. But like I said, it's people can get too caught up in the technicalities. It's kind of five bows or seven bows where everything's touching the ground. But and you're trying to do it mindfully. But like I said, the true respect is in the heart. Some people can bow very beautifully. And can be quite disrespectful as well. So it's not just the act. But anyway, since you asked, I have to give a bit of demonstration. Okay, so the hand goes right here, right? It goes up. You lower yourself, hands and elbow and head all the way down. That counts as one. No. Right? Yeah, so that's called the five-point bow, I think. Seven. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, it's everything touching. But sometimes it gets a bit, truncated. So you see some people going. Yeah, so technically that also qualifies. Yeah. But generally you want to bow as graceful, as mindful, because obviously that's the reason why you bow, and it's bringing up, you know, wholesome qualities. Yeah. Okay, so that's the bowing. Questions or comments? Yes?
Does that mean anything, or is that just...
No, that's not so I know. Doesn't mean anything, but I can be wrong. Yeah. That's just kind of low in your head, I guess, or something.
But if you put elbows, that's nine. Because
that one, two.
Feet, knees, hands, that's six. You can
nine. All right, are you sure? One, two, to nine? Okay. So I'm wrong. So it's a 9-point bow. Maybe. But now that, because you've seen, like, you see very kind of graceful pictures, they always put the elbow down.
Okay, so yeah.
9-point bow. I know. So the more points, the more merit, I think. Okay, it's a request to come for a 9-day retreat. This is up to the retreat coordinator. I think the center is becoming very popular, so it was quite booked up this year. Yeah, so see what happens next year. Is it considered rude not to join in with the chanting, but to just listen? And is everyone encouraged to bow to the Buddha? No, if you're not feeling comfortable, just kind of sit back and listen and stand with the bowing. It's completely optional. Do what you feel inspired to do. Yeah? I feel something is missing in my life. I try to be content with what I have, but somehow I can't be at peace. Any suggestion how to find peace? I think this is basically the existential problem of being humans. You want to be happy, want to be peaceful, but how? Yeah. And so there's nothing wrong with this, just feeling very normal. And it's just through training the mind that we can become more peaceful gradually. And then that's what the wonderful gift the Buddha left behind is, this training of finding peace and contentment and sense of well-being, of finding meaning in the life. But so wanting to find peace is a starting point, but it's also training yourself, inclining towards wholesome states. So as the mind becomes more clear, more subtle, there's a natural sense of contentment, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of connection with the people around us, yeah. But it's something that happens gradually. Yeah. So, how to find peace. So, as in Chan also said, looking for peace is like looking for a tortoise with a mustache. You don't find it. But when your heart becomes more peaceful, when your heart is clear, then peace will come looking for you. Yeah. So something that is ability just to be present, to be still. So, tell people over and over again, whatever it is that you're looking for, peace, fulfillment, love, respect, it's already here, really. It's all inside yourself, all buried deep in the present moment. You just have to stay still long enough for these things to come to you, for these things to open up. Yeah, it's the fact that we move around so much that we miss these things. Yeah, so just stay where you are. Then things will come. Questions, comments? Dear Ajahn, when focused on breath, suddenly mind will start organizing or planning something. Then I realize my active mind can't stop. It comes in to work. Try to tell my mind. The mind doesn't have anything to do other than watching the breath. Then suddenly sleep has come. Then I tell subconscious mind not sleep time yet. It's just the way. Yeah, this is also very kind of a common problem with meditation, is that we have a very active mind. So when you sit with nothing to do, its habit is to start thinking, planning, doing different things, because it moves around. And it does this all the time. But a lot of times we don't notice because we're moving around with it, doing things, organizing. And when you sit still, these things come up. And it's fine. The fact that you notice the mind is moving, that's a big first step. Yes, and now focusing on a simple object like the breath. And every time it moves away, you realize it, move it back. That is the practice. Nothing wrong with that. It's where the training comes in. Just find it, drift away, move it back. Drift away, move it back. With gentleness, but firm. And then over time, it will, you know, get the point, and it will stay with the breath longer and longer. But you have to do it with, you know, with gently. Just move it back with patience. You know, with irritation, not trying to force it on the breath. Not trying to kind of use too much willpower. And over time, it will kind of eventually, you know, stay with the breath. And the other, yeah, the other extreme is true, that because, you know, we have such active mind, then when you sit and when you say nothing to do, it starts to fall asleep. Because that's the only time when you don't do anything, it's when you're sleeping. Yeah? So sloth and torpor is also a common problem. I remember myself, you know, having a very active life and mind, that as soon as I sit down, I would just fall asleep because, well, I'm not doing anything. The only time I didn't do anything was when I was sleeping. So the body and the mind thinks the same. I was sitting still, eyes closed, must be bedtime. What else? Yeah, so it falls asleep. So it's something that gradual training as well. Over time, you set up the mind. So that's why it's always when you set up your posture, it's a balance between being comfortable, but awake and alert as well. That's why we recommend that not to start out doing the lying down posture too much. Because it really, really kind of, you know, bring you to sleepiness if you're not used to it. Yeah. Questions, comments? Question. The energy of the mind as regards, I think, emotions and feelings. Could you speak further on this, please? The energy of the mind, it's not so much emotions or feeling. It's this brightness. You know, sometimes you visual, you close your eyes. Sometimes it's dark, but then when the mind starts to settle, there's a brightness in the mind. It's like almost a light. Or the energy in the mind is when it can express itself in the body. Body feels light and comfortable. It's not this heaviness that you feel. Yeah, so that's the energy in the mind when the mind becomes more still, more subtle, more clear. There's a buoyancy. You open your eyes, everything's just a bit clearer. Everything has a sparkle to it. Yeah, food tastes better. Everything's more, a bit more beautiful for some reason. Yeah, that's the energy of the mind. Not so much the emotions or the feelings. Ajahn, you have spoken of being with a feeling. Could you describe how to do this, please? Say, with sadness or joy. Is it interrogation of sorts? No. I try to kind of encourage people just to be like, see how the feelings and emotion express themselves in the physical body. You know, is it with sadness? Is this kind of a slight tightness of the abdomen or around the shoulder? Or is it kind of a tightness around the jaw area? And with joy, is it kind of an opening up, a lightness in the body? And it does, because our mind and body are very kind of attached together. It affects each other. Yeah. So trying to feel the physical expression of your emotion, try to understand, you get to know that. Especially with the negative emotion, where there's a tightness. Try to relax that. Relax your shoulders, your abdomen, your stomach. You'll find that your emotional state also gets a bit more relaxed. Because when sometimes we get stressed, you know, we think a lot. And the more we think, the more stressed we are, the more tight we get. But by kind of releasing, relaxing the tight areas in the body, you find that the mind itself is a bit more not so stressed out. Because you're not thinking so much about your trigger that's making you stressed. Nothing about the story, the narrative that we feed ourselves over and over again to increase the stress. Yeah. Questions or comments? We're certainly asking questions like a 9-day retreat. Come on, a question for a weekend. Dear Ajahn, I've been trying and trying, but not getting anywhere in my meditation. My weakness is sloth and torpor. How can I get through this? Sometimes I feel very discouraged. Please advise. Sloth and torpor is also, like I said, it's a normal expression of the mind from time to time. Unless you're fully enlightened, I always remind people, these five kind of hindrances, obstacles to peace, will be in the mind. So there'll be desires, wanting something, craving, looking for something, and then irritation, want to get rid of some things, feeling annoyed with something. And then there's the sloth and torpor, feeling a bit dull. And then there's doubt, not knowing whether you should be doing this meditation object or that meditation, should be here, or doing something else. Yeah, so it's kind of thinking about, and it's just restless thinking, moving around, thinking about all sorts of different things. And those are kind of almost natural states for an untrained mind. Yeah, so when you sit down, instead of thinking it's, you know, you're a failure, something's done wrong, no, just expect one of these five. Sometimes you feel like all five of them are there to entertain you. Just reflect on these and find ways to overcome them. With sloth and torpor, sometimes just meditate with your eyes a bit open. Yeah, or do some walking meditation. That's a good way to kind of bring up, rouse up some energy. Some standing meditation. Yeah, because a lot of times you have a busy life, lots of responsibility, work schedule. Then yeah, when you sit down, sleepiness will take over. So I said, you know, for the first few days, I know it's only a weekend retreat, but sometimes a 9-day retreat, encourage people just, you know, catch up on your sleep the first few days. Yeah, because sometimes we run around and we're quite sleep deprived, do not know it. Yeah, but there's a good test, whether it's sloth and torpor or whether you're just sleep deprived, is that after you had your nap, and if you get to sit, and you're still get sleepy, sloth and torpor, and that's a sloth and torpor, because obviously you just woke up from a nap. Yeah, but you wake up and you're bright and ready to meditate, then yeah, obviously you needed that sleep. Yeah, so not to be too worried. These are kind of normal problems that everybody faces when they meditate. Thing is not to take the bait and to think it's, you know, to get annoyed with it, to start doubting yourself, to start criticizing yourself. Yes, and just to step back. It's not your problem, it's just sloth and torpor. And how to overcome that. Yeah. So see, this is it's a challenge. It's not a personal failing, it's just, you know, life is full of challenges. And we all have the wisdom, intelligence to overcome anything if we don't give up. Okay. Questions or comments? Yes.
If you're doing this at home and you're not too sure as to what's happening, so there are a lot of guided meditations on the BSWA site that will help you out.
Yes, thanks for that. It's a good comment. Yeah, some people find as well, and I've heard a few of those from the interviews, that they do meditate better with guided meditation. So certainly, yeah, use the BSWA one. The other one I like to recommend to people is the apps. There are a lot of apps that gives you guided meditation, you know, 20, 30 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Some of them play music, that way it keeps you kind of engaged. Yeah, So use those kind of tools to help you get started. Yeah. Thanks for that. Comments? Yeah?
The one who learns from Vajrayana, I think it's Ajahnathi,
uh-huh.
recommends in cases of sleepiness to take a few deep breaths. And I find that technique very useful.
Okay, yeah, sure.
It does wake you up.
Mm-hmm.
And it relaxes the body at the same time. I even used it when I was once driving home from down south, and there was nowhere to stop at night.
Oh, okay.
And I was getting sleepy, and I was worried. And I was too afraid to stop on the side of the road.
All right, okay.
And I just kept myself awake with deep breathing.
Deep breathing, okay, that's very good.
Happy can be credited for me.
That's right, that's
honestly,
a good value.
It's a very good technique. I found it extremely useful.
Okay. Yeah, I think the traditional technique is that Buddha recommend rubbing your earlobe. That's a stimulating thing. Water if you're not driving, yeah, you can flush water on your face. Yeah. Yeah. As in cha, so you know, stop breathing for a few minutes. That way you up as well. That's right. Go find a really high spot. Climb onto the wall. Sit there. We had one. I think a novice or monk who used to walk up and down the wall avoiding on the front road to keep him awake at night. I don't recommend that. If you fall, you'll sue us. So don't do that. Okay. Very nice. I usually meditate alone. Whilst I like being in the meditation hall, I get very distracted by noise and movement. I try to think positively that the noise brings me back to the breath, but it's hard. Should I persevere or find my own space? Good question. Being distracted by noise and movement, it's part of a learning process. Every meditation retreat, there's always somebody who knocks over something all the time when just about to get into meditation, or the door slams, or someone snores. So the ability just to not worry, really just to, you know, kind of shut the external and just be focused on your breath, is something that, you know, each and every one of you have to learn eventually. You know, it's the process about letting go of the external, and also the process about making peace with the externals. Not to get carried away, not to get annoyed, not to give into irritation. Yeah. But sometimes it can be helpful. If you suffer from sloth and torpor, then it's great. People run around banging things, oh, wakes you up. Oh, okay, I'm here back in the hall again. People, you know, burping, farting, all sorts of things happening. It's like, oh yeah, okay, I'm awake again. Back here. Yeah. So it varies, but if you find it too distracting and you just sit there fuming all the time, and then it's finally good to kind of go back to your room and do a couple of sessions by yourself. Yeah. But I found it incredibly useful just to be in the room with people as a young monk, because it does, you know, allows you to work through, you know, the external noise. And Ajahn Chah's famous phrase is that, yeah, it's not the noise that disturbs you. It's you disturbing the noise. Because the noise is like a split second, bang, it's gone. But it's like, oh, that idiot that banged that door again. There's a big sign right there, not to pull the door. They pulled the wrong door. It's ridiculous. I have to go talk to Bianca about this. And he goes, oh, no, for half an hour. It's just a noise in the door, right? Yeah. So it's just the ability just to go, okay, it's just a noise, back to the breath. Whatever happened, just back to the breath. Yeah. And it's a skill that you need to kind of work on over the long term. Yeah. Questions or comments?
Isn't it tolerance like one of the paramis?
Patient endurance, yeah. It's one of the spiritual qualities. Yeah, patient, yeah. It's the ability just to, yes, we live in the world and, you know, it's very irritating to live with other humans. It's just, and now 60 of them, whoa. Lots of opportunity to practice patience. And it's just that, and that's the Sangha life is the same. You know, just day in, day out, grinding, living with each other, annoying each other, until you just give up being annoyed. And yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes?
It's the opposite. is also a skill to learn to be quiet, to learn not to bang
your head. It is. That's right.
I know this is something that when I first started meditating and first went to retreat, I found incredibly difficult to do. I always seemed to be knocking things, slamming things, accidentally going to the wrong door. So that is a skill in itself that is part of the retreat, I think.
It is, and as you... It is. It's another level of mindfulness, clarity, and like an offering. And you see that the professional ones, they're very quiet. You know, the professional retreatants. And you know who you are. I see you all the time. They're very quiet. They move, glide effortlessly. Yeah. So it is true. And you can see that in people who can come a lot. They're, you know, they know the routine. They know which door to grab and, you know, how to move quietly. And it's a skill that you do pick up over time, that you're more aware of, you know, where your bottle is, and you don't know. But even with the best intention, occasionally, you know, even I do it, I know, nothing, so or whatever, you're sitting there. So it does happen, but certainly you try to minimize it. And it is out of compassion and out of care for other people that you do try to move, you know, silently, try to, you know, wear the clothing that doesn't kind of rub all the time. Yeah, it is. It is something that is. And it's a good offer to the community when you do come in and practice. Yeah. Questions or comments? That's right. That's a comment. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu to all those kind people helping out on the retreat. Great merit to them. Especially the people who are sweeping up the little crawling creatures so we don't step on them. Thank you very much. There you go. Okay. Development of wisdom faculty, night. If I steal my mind, I can look at it and decide what I want it to work on as opposed to doing what it likes. Then who am I? And is my mind only borrowed for the short time of my physical life?
That was mine.
Okay. Yeah, you answered. We talked about it in the interview. Okay.
To do with, you know, my physical body and my,
that's right,
my non-physical body, my mind.
That's right.
Who runs the show?
That's right. Well, it's a bit about the certain part of it, your physical body. Obviously, you need it to do the thing. Yeah. But the one that pulls the string is the mind, which is, you know, a non-material thing.
So the mind's running the show.
Mind is running the show. To a certain extent, but if you're sick, you can't force, you know, can't force the body to do what it wants if it's sick. Yeah, so a certain extent, there are physical limitations to what the mind can do, but the mind is the one that directs. You know, you have to have intention to come here, then you have to start driving and planning, and then you arrive here. But then you cannot arrive here unless the body, you know, is in a certain physical condition. If it's really sick and can't move, then of course you can.
There are competing interests then.
Yeah, I try to explain to people that it's not one of you in there. There's like a co-committee. Yes, and you have to negotiate lots of little things. You know, there's someone that wants to be, you know, good, want to do the right thing. And then there's a rebel who wants to do what he or she wants to do, regardless of everybody else. Yeah, so you have to understand, expect that. Yeah, this is competing forces in the mind. Yeah.
So my body, really, is just looking after all this stuff. Till my body's worn out, then it just shoots off somewhere else and
that's right.
Annoys somebody else.
It finds another body. There's just an energy. When you die, your physical thing is gone. The still an energy. They're still craving, wants to do something, wants to have more fun.
Yeah, right.
It wants to have another body. Until you realize that it's not really fun. And then you start wanting. But until then, yeah, it's, oh yeah, I'll get another body. Want more fun. Yeah, more things to do. Yeah. Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, when doing metta meditation, is it good to spend time sending metta to oneself before moving on to the three categories of other people? It varies. Sometimes people find it hard to send metta to themselves. And then, so sometimes I recommend that you could be the last person to send metta. So you do it to your enemy, you could, you know, kind of have strong, stable metta to send to your enemy. Then you can also send to yourself. Yeah. So it varies. Other times you can start with yourself first, just, you know, build up, send a metta to yourself, and then start to focus on different aspects. So whichever works for you, just experiment. You know, start with yourself first and send it outward, or start with others and then send inward. Because some people have, you know, obviously issues, mistakes they made, remorse, guilt, feeling not good enough, feeling not adequate, then they find it hard to start with themselves. If that's the case, then you can receive it towards the end when the metta meditation is strong and stable. Yeah. When trying to send metta to the difficult person, I found myself doing it grudgingly, like I was holding back. It felt insincere saying some of the phrases you said, because I don't think I'm ready to mean it 100% to this person yet. How to work with this skillfully? To me, faking it till you make it just feels fake, not dummy. Thank you. Yes, it's fake. But remember, I said that only move to the difficult person if the metta is strong and stable and powerful. Then it doesn't feel fake. But it's true, if it feels fake, then just stay with the neutral person first. Yeah, until you build up kind of the energy, build up this feeling of, yes, even, you know, this person who really annoyed you and really abused you, cheated you, lied to you, you still can wish them well-being. I'm not saying have a coffee with them, I'm not saying, you know, take a holiday with them. I'm saying just, okay, you know, I want to be happy, so I'll, by inference, we all want to be happy. So I still wish you happiness. Yeah. I still wish you well-being. I may not want to, go on a road trip with you, but you still can be happy. You can still be happy. Yeah, so it's more like that. I'm not saying, hang out with them or anything. Yeah. Questions or comments?
In the Ramadi Sutra retreat, there was an answer to this one.
Okay.
I think, I forget the number, but it is called the resentment of, removal of resentments.
Uh-huh.
There is a sutra, but it says is that look at some good quality in that person.
Mm.
There may be, he may be bodily, he may have bodily bad actions, he may have mental, he may be meditating for a little while at least.
Okay.
Maybe verbally, he may be a good person.
That's right.
Also, what it says is look at some good quality
that's
in that person and then try to expand that.
That's right. Try to focus on that. Whatever you focus on.
On that, I think the name is called removal of resentment.
Resentment. Okay. Can't remember number. Okay.
I think it is in, is it correct?
Five?
Anguttara five.
Okay, yeah. The group of discourse, not a group of discourse, the numerical discourses. Numerical discourses, group of fives of those who were interested. And yeah, it's true, the advice is to, look at the positive quality, because everybody has some. When we don't like somebody, obviously we only think of their negative qualities, and we think that defines them. But no, common sense, intelligence says, you know, everybody's a mixture of both. And even if they're terrible, you know, somebody loves them, their mother loves them, their wife loves them, the kid loves them. Yeah. So even Hitler, you know, had a fan, right? I'm sure his mother loved him. Yeah, so just looking for positive qualities in another. And it's with anything, it's a training of the mind. Focusing something. And focusing positivity brightens the mind up. Increase, inspires you, gives you energy. Focus on negativity brings the opposite. Yeah. So it's the metta, even though you send it to them, it's the, actually something that you purify yourself as a result of that. Yeah. Yes?
What I do is I pardon them for all, anything that they've done.
That's right.
If their body, speech or mind, and then
yes, right.
I beg pardon from them too because I know I've done something to them too.
Forgiveness is a form of metta as well. Yeah, you know, I forgive you and we can move on. Yeah, so that's the form. That's why I allow the free time to kind of work on your own kind of dialogue, your narrative, to relate to this person. Yeah.
And the last one, it says if someone doesn't have any good qualities, treat him as a sick person. So if someone is sick,
that's
mentally,
right.
Unstable,
yeah.
You don't fall angry with such a person.
That's right. Someone that's like always saying mean things to different people. Also, you don't take it personally. Sometimes we have those characters in the Sangha. They always get into arguing with different people. And you see it happening every day. So it's like, okay, yeah, today's my turn. He's going to pick a fight with me. That's okay. It's not personal. Just my turn's up.
Yeah.
So you see that. So you don't take it personally. You realize, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah. Questions or comments? I know I shouldn't say much because you think, oh, monks are enlightened. We must be so harmonious. Not always. Okay, you said Western way is experimenting and believing yourself, not faith. Isn't this what the Buddha said in one sutta? Or sermon, don't believe anything because it comes on from generations or parents or teacher said it. Believe something after practicing it. Yeah, it's true. The Buddha said, you know, not to believe because you read it, not from a teacher. But with anything, it's just testing it. Yeah. You know, try it out something, test it. And then if it works, then you can invest your faith in it. If it doesn't work, you discard it and you try something else. So this ability just to test things. And faith, Buddhism is not faith, you know, believe or not believe. It's kind of it's a starting point. It's kind of a testing the hypothesis. You know, is this true or not? If I do this, and you do it, you find out whether it's true. You know, practice meditation, practice generosity. Does that bring happiness? Does it bring a sense of connection? If it doesn't, say, okay, yeah, you know, okay, something that's positive. And you believe in, you know, keeping the sila, keeping the rules, not harming yourself, not harming others. Does that bring a sense of well-being when you refrain from killing living creatures, taking what's not given, lying, cheating? After all, it brings a sense of contentment, brings a sense of well-being, brings a sense of respect. And you realize, okay, yeah, it's worthwhile to live an ethical life, live a life of integrity, straightforwardness. But something you have to know for yourself. Yeah, it's not something that comes above. You don't get extra credit points for keeping the precepts or whatever. It's something that we each, every one of us, have discovered for ourselves. Yeah, whether it works or not. Dear Ajahn, if meditating is done poorly, will this lead to a permanently poor result? Or will any meditation lead to good outcome? Quality versus quantity, time. No, I mean, you look at it wisely, looking at with wise reflection. There's nothing as a bad meditation. I do believe that. It's like, you know, Lupo Lim, one, you know, the great meditation master from China. He said, you know, good meditation is like making a sculpture, you know, to get a perfect, beautiful Buddha Rupa, you have to go through a few kind of trial and error. It's like really, you know, kind of a ugly, misshaping statue. And then you have one final one that's really nice. So Is it correct to say that those other ones are mistakes or not? No, it is through those mistakes that you arrive at this beautiful Buddha statue. So it is through the not so great meditations that you learn to work with the mind to arrive at, you know, the deep meditation. Yeah, and like I was trying to remind people after each sessions, that it's just getting to know the mind. It's not always peace that you judge your effort as success. If the mind is distracted, okay, no, what does that feel like? It just feels that much, not the end of the world. Yeah, the mind is not still, it's just not much. When the mind becomes still, it feels like that. Yeah, just know your state of mind. Where is it that you go when you're not peaceful? There's certain stories that you tell yourself, memories, fantasies, situations. Just know, okay, that's interesting. That's where my mind goes. Interesting. I never knew that. Or these things that's kind of underneath, that's coming up. Emotional issues that comes up. Oh, okay, that's interesting. I'm still carrying that around. Being bullied when I was 3 years old or 5 years old. Oh, that's interesting. That's coming up. Yeah. So it's just understanding our own kind of inner world that we meditate. And as you understand, you purify the mind, it does become still naturally on its own. Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, can you please talk about finding the right balance in your practice? How have you figured out the application of right effort? What has kept you on for so many years in the ropes? What has helped you along the way? Right balance is something that each and every one of us have to figure out for ourselves. Sometimes it is putting more effort, putting just more time onto the cushion, sitting longer, sitting later into the night, waking up early in the morning, push yourself a little bit. And other times, it's just kind of stepping back, you know, get a bit more sleep, doing other things, bit of chanting, bit of studying. Yeah. So it's always a combination of different activities to kind of strengthen and nurture your spiritual life. Yeah, sometimes talking with other people, other times it's, you know, keeping silence, keeping restraint. Yeah, so it is something that you all have to experiment. What is it that you need? And I said over and over again, it's, you know, this sense of connecting, being present of what you need at this time in your practice. And adjusting, does it work or doesn't work? More of this, you know, more silence, more practice, less practice, more sleep. Yeah, always adjusting, play around, you know, with the food. In monastic life, there's a few areas that we focus on. Sometimes early morning chanting, the sitting, how awake, how aware you are doing that. And then it's the food intake, how much food you should take, and talking, how much talking to do. Obviously, the standard recommendation is to minimize it, but sometimes it's good to have a good chat with the body from time to time, just to connect, to share. So it is something that you have to work out for yourself. And right effort, yeah, it's the same. What's kept in the ropes for so many years? I think it's just a sense of a bit of stubbornness. Like I'm not giving up no matter what. You know, I've got my fair share of distractions, fair share of failures or whatever, fair share of disappointments. But still, I'm not giving up. Just gonna keep on walking. One day at a time. Yeah. One breath at a time. Just continue. But also there's a lot of happiness though that comes from living the holy life. A lot of joy, just, you know, sharing the spiritual journey with others. And just know, you know, being part of something I feel greater than myself, part of the Dhamma wheel that's rolling, you know, creating wholesome conditions in the world, spreading love, spreading meditation, spreading peace and compassion. Yeah, and it's something that I feel, yeah, you know, kind of very, very honored to be part of. And so that's kept me going over the years. And also, yeah, being the teacher, being the senior monk at the center in Sydney, just seeing the benefit that it does, not specifically, you know, my teaching or anything, but just having a quiet place for people to come to. Sometimes I'm very confused, distracted, a bit sad and depressed. And just a few days, few weeks of, you know, being around really good people, harmless, encouraging people, being in a quiet place, a bit of meditation, a bit of restraint, and you can see there's a completely different person. Yeah. Sometimes our physical appearance is a manifestation of a mental. So they come in, they're very dark and sad and, you know, bags under the eyes. And it's just a few weeks and it's just a brightness, the glowing that comes out. You know, they feel more peaceful, you know, more rested. Yeah. And that's been a great kind of joy to witness, kind of a Dhamma unfolding in different people in different ways. Yeah. So that's what I find quite encouraging to be part of. So that's the thing that kind of drive me on to stay in the robes. But no grand plans. I haven't made some kind of vows that I'm going to do this forever and ever and ever. It's more one day at a time, you know, 1 year at a time, see what happens. But things are really going really, really well, feeling much peace, settledness. So I can't imagine anything in the world that would take me away. I visit home once a year, and my families are not the Buddhist nor practitioner. So they want the old person back. Oh, why aren't you finished with this monk thing? Can you be normal again? Come back to the parties. Come back to the holidays. Look at me. And they're, you know, successful in the worldly way. Look at my new house. Look at my new holiday. Look at my new cars. Don't you want one of these? It's like, not really. And I could tell them, you do anything interesting, I might come back. Well, you haven't done anything interesting. Yeah, you know, same thing, work, relationships, emotions, holidays, like, yeah, it's okay. Yeah. When I sleep, I have many dreams. Even if I take a short nap, I dream. Is my mind too restless? A little bit. You think a lot, it carries on until your sleeping postures. It's fine. It's not the end of the world. It's just the mind, you know, doing this thing, working out different issues. Yeah, when you are closing your eyes. But as you find that the mind becomes more still, you dream less. You don't have any kind of graphic dream. What's the word they call it? It doesn't become so kind of emotional thing. Yeah, it's just kind of as the mind becomes more peaceful, yeah, it's just not much happening when you are sleeping. Yeah. Mm. You feel more rested, that's for sure. Mm. Questions or comments? What's the word that says been practiced that they do with the dreaming? What do you call that? Not graphic dreaming, but lucid, yeah, not lucid, that's what I think so. Huh? Yeah. You find that once your mind's more settled, you don't, your dreams aren't so lucid that it's just, you know, different bits and pieces, memories that floats in or whatever. Ajahn, how do I deal with feelings of anxiety during meditation? Anxiety and worry during the retreat about being away from work. As the retreat progresses, it gets worse as the day passes. During the retreat. Anxiety is just, a lot of it is just part of, you know, thinking a lot, worrying, and it shows, you know, the attachment around certain issues. Sometimes you can kind of, and if anxiety shows up, sometimes it's hard to kind of reason with it. But at that time you can reason that, you know, that obviously, you know, you disappear from the face of the earth, work will sort itself out automatically. You know, your kids, your family, you've gone away before and you come back, you know, they're still fine. You know, they haven't burned down the house, they haven't done anything, they worked themselves out. Yes, they kind of talk yourself, but sometimes it's not so rational. So also I encourage people just to go to the body. Where is the feeling of anxiety? How is it expressing itself in your body again? Where's the tension? Where's the tightness? And trying to release, relax, soothe that physical symptom of your anxiety. And it does two things, going to the body. One is that you bring in some relief to the body by kind of relaxing, releasing the tension. And the other one is it short circuit the thinking bit. You're not thinking so much, so you're not getting more stress. You focus on something else. Yeah, so just a few minutes of focusing the body, relaxing, just lying down, even just massaging the tight parts of yourself. It's okay, it's all gonna be okay, it's all good. Relaxing. And you'll find that the anxiety will start slowly to dissipate by itself. Yeah. But also, if it's a chronic thing, then also to approach it in a way that it's a lesson here, it's a friend, something that comes because it's with you all the time. Instead of kind of suppress it, push it away out of fear and nervousness, out of irritation, just try to learn, what is it? It's teaching me something. It's trying to teach me something. It's not very pleasant, but it's trying to teach me something. And try to be with it, to learn from it. Try to figure out, what is it? There's a lesson here somewhere. Yeah? So always say, see this thing as an opportunity to learn about yourself. An opportunity to embrace. Remember, there's different aspects of yourself. We only want to focus the beautiful stuff, the nice stuff, the enlightened one, the happy one, the peaceful one. But there is the darker side, the opposite. It's also within ourselves. So this ability to allow that to come out, to embrace it, to learn from it, it's also a way to purify the mind. Yeah, because so much of it, we push away the sides of us, the irritated side, the petty side, the mean, the cruel side. We don't acknowledge it, and that stays there. Yeah. So it's only allowing that to come, embracing it, understanding it, that these, unless you become fully enlightened, these forces are there, and it's okay. Yeah, they have their place. You don't want to express them, but they're just, they're natural forces of the mind as well. Yeah, so trying to understand them. Try to learn from them. To grow. And then once the understanding, they disappear on their own. They disappear when they're ready. Not when you think it's convenient, but when you want them to. Yeah. So sometimes the suppressing, it's like a spring, that makes them stronger and they come back with force later on. That's why people start to rely on medication after a while. But with meditation, with contemplation, we can't work with these negative state of mind. And actually, it's something that it brings a better result. Because medication, the body's developed, obviously, tolerance to it. And you have to take more and more medication. It clouds your mindfulness. And that's other things. But the ability just to be with unpleasant things. It's a training, it's a muscle also that you can train. So you can be with anxiety, you can be with anything. You can be with an unpleasant person, unpleasant situation, and not give rise to irritation. And it's just great. It brings a lot of confidence in yourself. It's a lot of self-esteem. But you have the strength just to be with things. Pleasant, unpleasant, beautiful, ugly, whatever it is. This openness, spaciousness, to accept life as it presents itself. Not having to divide things. Not having to select things. But just open your awareness to everything. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yes? No, it's true. And also there's the middle way, like with anxiety coming up, not to buy into the whole narrative of anxiety, why, how things could go wrong and the million ways it could go wrong. So that's getting sucked into it. But also not suppressing it. So the ability just to see for what it is and say, okay, there's anxiety about certain things, but not buying into it. So it's in the middle way of looking at the narrative, but not really get sucked into the stories. And then also the ability to work with it, like I recommend people, You know, now it's meditation time. So the next half an hour, I'm going to try to just focus on the breath, or focus on the body. But other issues that come up, I'm going to attend to them later. Yeah. So there's ability to also try, you know, to have, you know, working with your mind in that way. That's, you know, time and place. Yeah. A bit of training around that issues as well. Yeah. So that's also helpful. Yes.
Yeah. How does that work? You're commenting or focusing on the good things. How does that also work with watching anxiety? I don't really. I haven't quite picked up what you're saying.
Okay. Generally, yes. Yeah. That you're trying to focus the mind on positive qualities, but at times, if you're prone to anxiety, prone to negativity, those starts to come up. But, you know, thinking, you know, you start to think about, yeah, you know, what if things, you know, go wrong when I go back and the kids are, you know, doing all sorts of things and they've, you know, set the kitchen on fire or my job, whatever, everything's going to fall apart. So you find yourself sort of veered towards that, but, you know, the different things that can go wrong in outside when you're sitting here. Yeah? And that will express itself, the anxiety will express itself in physical symptoms somewhere. There's a tightness. There's a tension either around your jaw, your shoulders, your stomach, your abdomen. So when you feel those things coming up, yeah, then the anxiety is kind of got a hold of you. So then you try to be with that first. By then, you're not thinking of the positive stuff anymore. By then, the mind is swamped with all the negative scenarios, the what-if scenario. So that's when, okay, it's a bit harder to think about positive things. So then you just try to be with the anxieties for a while. Yeah, let's see, okay, what else is there? What's happening here? Yeah, and then try to kind of step back a little bit, get some perspective and see, okay, where the mind is going. Usually it's going to, you know, kind of a negativity, panic, all the things that could go wrong. Yeah, so okay. Yeah, but a lot of time, if it's kind of a chronic thing, you realize, yeah, okay, I've seen this before, this happens before. Yeah, so try not to buy into that story. A lot of time we get sucked into the story and you start worrying, really, you know, what's going to go wrong, whatever. I come back and, you know, the car is going to be broken and, you know, the doors are open, there's, you know, there's rain everywhere, there's water, and I've got to sweep this stuff. Yeah. So, you know, okay, I've seen this before. So I'm just going to watch. Instead of thinking about it, I'm just going to try to go to the body first. Try to relax, soothe that first. Yeah. But if when the mind is, you know, in its normal state and it's not caught in anxiety, then you try to focus on positive stuff as an antidote to any kind of, you know, anxious thoughts that might arise. Yeah, does that make sense? Okay. Yes?
So if everything that comes up in us is just about us watching our experience and understanding and learning about ourselves, then in your opinion, what is the, or is there any merit in like kind of modern therapies like hypnotherapy or energy therapies that say that they can kind of go into the subconscious or go into the energy body and take these emotions or sensations away?
I am not so up onto these kind of energy hypnotic kind of techniques. I think any techniques that kind of take the responsibility from yourself, or something you need somebody to take the negative out of yourself, might be a short-term fix, but long-term it's not great. Because meditation is what I'm trying to impart, is the ability to kind of do that yourself, the ability to kind of solve your own issues that come up. Yeah, and that's much more empowering, much more useful, the ability to, you know, calm the mind, to be with negative mental states, and then purify the mind on your own. Because otherwise, every week you're going to come up and give the $100 away, sit for an hour, take negativity away. Yeah, and then it's very dependent on that. What happened that you know, the teacher moves away or whatever? Yeah. So maybe sometimes when you're overpowered by negativity, and this is a good fix for a week or two, but I would encourage people really to kind of, you know, focus on the practice that you can learn to calm yourself down. to learn from the negativity, or to work with the negative mental states that come up from time to time. Yeah, because I know people in psychotherapy, and they go for years and years, and they're still like 10 years later, they're still going, it's like, what's going on? Yeah. But sometimes people get kind of used to, addicted to, you know, going somewhere, you know, talking about certain things, and feeling a bit better. But they're not having the wisdom to really kind of solve that. Yeah, there's certain issues that they're working with. Yeah. And what, that's what the practice is about. It's, you know, having your own wisdom, intelligence, yeah, have understanding into your situation, your habits, you know, why you feel the way you do, and how to navigate that, how to improve on that, how to focus on the positive thing. And I think a bit of meditation, a bit of clarity, should be able to see through certain things pretty quickly, actually.
I find that.
Go ahead.
Would you be able to tell us about your center in Sydney?
My center in Sydney?
Yeah. How far away from Sydney Central? Or
it's
a description about the center.
Okay, a few minutes plug for the center. It's about 2.5 hours north of Sydney. And its name is Wat Buddha Dhamma. And it's been around for a long time, since 1978. So about almost 40 years. And but it was, not doing very well. It was a meditation center before I arrived. And I've just been there for the last 8 years and kind of turned it back into a forest monastery. So it's a quiet monastery, nowhere as busy and as big as this, as Ajahn Brahm's place. I think like Ajahn Brahm's normal date, it's like our katina. You know, once a year, we get that many people visit. Usually, it's like on Sunday, a few family comes, and they offer enough food. The rest of the week, the practitioner, they cook up what's in the pantry. But it's a quiet place in the middle of the national park. And very basic, but I find it a very beautiful place of practice. And I do. I tell people who stays there, I tell people who's coming, that it's paradise on earth. You can't find a more beautiful spot. Your practice, yeah. So that's the center. So it's Wat Buddha Dhamma, and you can just Google it and find the directions in different ways. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Well, that had to do with the anxiety of being.
Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
I think sometimes it's just a question of rationalizing. Mm. In my case, and I suppose there are degrees of anxiety in us, but we all are prone to some. And when I was coming on my first 9-day retreat, that was 4 years ago when you ran it, and I asked my neighbor to look after the house, as in take the bin out on a particular day. And she said, okay, so if something happens, where do I call you? I said, you can't. My phone will be switched off. You can't call me. She goes, so what do I do? I said, nothing. Just wait till I come back. And that was, I'm so grateful for her reaction, because that made me take a step back and think, what could really happen? And it's different because I don't have family, I'm single, so it's a different thing as when you leave behind, I have my husband, kids and all of that. And I thought that what can happen? Either a burglary or fire. So I said to her, if it's a burglary, call the police.
That's right.
If it's fire, call the fire brigade.
Yeah.
I couldn't help being away.
Yes, sir.
And whatever's happened, I'll deal with it when I come back. And I was perfectly peaceful and did not spare another thought to my house and what I left behind. And I think it's because she asked me that question and I gave her that answer. It made me reflect. And I think sometimes reflecting on causes of our anxieties makes us rationalize and think it's really quite silly. You know, it's letting go of controls. We do tend to be control freaks sometimes, and allowing that, can I really control certain things? Not really. I mean, what's the difference of being here away for 9 days or being in the next Sabbath at work? If something dramatic happens, it happens.
That's right.
You are not there supervising things 24/7 everywhere. So it's just a question of degree and reflecting. And taking a rational view of these matters, I find is very helpful.
No, it does. You know, just using rationality, and sometimes that works. Other times, it's more of an emotional thing, that even though you can rationalize, it still comes up, oh, what if? Yeah. But certainly, the rationality does help to a certain extent. Yeah, definitely. Questions, comments? Okay, just two more, sorry. When you say meditation results, is feeling more connected. What do you mean? Connected to what? Other people, nature? Yeah, everything. Like you feel like we are all part of something really beautiful, something great. I know it's kind of new agey, but that's the feeling. You want to go hug every tree you see? No, but also, it's sometimes hard to put it into words, like feeling a connection, but also feeling like we're complete in ourselves as well, like we're individuals. So but it's feeling of kind of oneness, and that is the effect of meditation, because you know normally you see this duality, me looking out into the world, but with meditation, sometimes you get absorbed into your meditation object, so there's this oneness. Yeah. So sometimes it's maybe not feeling of connectedness, that doesn't work for you, but feeling of everything is good, everything is right, everything has its place. Yeah. So all is good in the world. You're good, the world's good, it's all good. So, yeah, something like that. It's a good feeling, however you want to interpret it. But it's true, like connected to others and also connected to nature. Because sometimes it is the feeling of alienation, of disconnectedness that, you know, that we do silly things. Like obviously global, you know, warming is feeling that, you know, we're not part of the nature, and we are very part of nature. So this feeling of care and compassion, not for your just for yourself, but as well as everything around you. Yeah, feeling with gentleness. It's not from just thinking, but it comes out truly. You do feel part of it, and it does matter what we do. Actions have consequences, and you want to have positive consequences with things around you, in whatever ways, just little ways even, like you know, sweeping up little. You know, creatures down there, something we don't have to. You know, or living very simple lifestyles, not consuming too much products. Yeah, little things. And when you're happy, you can do all that. When you're not happy, then you shop and shop and shop and consume. But when you're happy and content, then yeah, you don't need to have that holiday. Don't need to have that new car, the big house. What you have is good enough. Because you're happy inside, you don't need to prove to other people that you're successful because you have a big car or whatever. Yeah. So there's this feeling of, yeah, you know, you're good. You know, you're happy in your own skin. Nothing to prove, nothing to do. Yeah. So that's the feeling of a good meditation. Or it could be a feeling of, you know, the really annoying husband that you had. And you open your eyes, he's the most wonderful person that you can ever hope to meet. Whatever shortcoming, you don't see that. You see the positive qualities only. Feeling appreciation and gratitude. You know, this person, this spouse of yours that you argue all the time with, all of a sudden become the most wonderful person that you can hope to be with. Yeah. And the most annoying monk that you sit next to, suddenly after a good meditation, he's so wonderful. So he's a great teacher for you to learn patience, to learn forgiveness, to learn compassion. Yeah. And that's what meditation can do, good meditation. Okay, final question. Dear Ajahn, have you ever used practices such as fasting or going without sleep? Do you find it useful? Any advice on how to use these skillfully? Are they okay for everyone? Thanks. Yes, in the forest tradition, we do a fair amount of fasting and go without sleep. Like I said, in some monastery, it's as regular as once a week that we try to stay up all night. just to see what that feels like, to give up sleep. Yeah. In a monastery, we do it maybe once a month at most. Sometimes we can go to 12 o'clock. So sometimes there's different ways to test the limits. And that's what the practice is about, just testing the limits of what you think, because we're so bound by our own self-imposed limitation. Yeah, and actually, the mind and the body is much more a flexible variable than you might think. You probably know, like fasting, right? We can, people cannot eat, you know, just on water for, I think, weeks and weeks at a time. But I'm not suggesting everybody do that. But yeah, certainly go without food for one day, see what happens. Yeah, a lot of time it does bring a bit of clarity, a bit of focus into the practice. Yeah. And same with without sleep. Yeah, just to see what that does. And cultivate, you know, wakefulness, giving up sleep for one night, or not lying down. See what that does. Yeah. So this is also staying with, you know, pushing the limit a little bit, playing with what you think you're capable of, adjusting the practice, but also arousing a sense of energy, a sense of enthusiasm for the practice. Because sometimes things get a bit too comfortable, but you get lulled into, you know, old habits and stuff. So in the forest tradition, good forest monastery is always pushing your limit a little bit, thing you cannot take anymore. Lots of sitting around, lots of waiting around, lots of patient endurance. Yeah. And after all, you gain something from that. Gain this kind of the muscles of the mind that says, yes, I can endure this. I can sit here a bit longer. Yeah. Ajahn Chah used to give talks like 4 hours, 5 hours, and he would say the same things over and over again. Drive you nuts. But it wears away this opinion. It's like, why don't he just shut up? I need to go to sleep. But in first edition, you sit. You can't even go to the toilet when he's talking. You got to sit through everything. Yeah. But it brings out the sense that, yes, you know, I can endure this, that you can't sit for another 10 minutes and it's not going to kill. And pretty soon you realize, oh, yeah, you just sat for 4 hours and it's not that big of a deal. Yeah. So the ability to sit, and sometimes, you know, in the modern world, we have things so easy, so convenient. What you want, you get right away. Shopping, bang, arrives to the door, same day delivery. You don't get same day, you get really annoyed. You don't get the color you want, you get really annoyed because everything is so there. Yeah. So as a result, the ability to endure unpleasantness, the ability to endure things, it's not very strong. Yeah. And we get shaken very quickly. We don't get what we want. Yeah, so it does make us a bit more weak and flabby in terms of mentally. Yeah, and that is a cause for concern. Yeah, so in the forest tradition, it's always this, you know, this kind of strengthening, toughening the mind up through different things. But also, there is, you know, a limit, a balance, that you don't want to push yourself where you're so uncomfortable, so miserable, that you're not getting enough sleep, and you're just so unhappy, that obviously then that's not wholesome states as well. But once a week, you know, getting letting go sleep once a month, not sleeping, you find it's not the end of the world. You can endure. Doctors and people do it all the time. I tell the young trainees we have, you know, they stay up all night playing video games. Why can't they stay up all night? You know, kind of for the Buddha. Oh no, I don't want to do that. Yeah, so it's more of the incentive, the state of mind that you bring to. But really, yeah, it's, you know, you find that when you stretch yourself that the mind can be quite strong and powerful. If you train it, if you put, you know, kind of train it gradually, yeah, something that we can endure. Sometimes we think, oh, I can't endure this. You know, we are already enduring it. Just a few more minutes. Yeah. It allows us to have this confidence that, yeah, you can be in a pleasant situation. When you're sick, you can have a lot of pain. But if you practice training yourself, you can accept the pain. You can endure it. You can sit through it and not be overwhelmed by it, yeah, by suffering. But it takes gradual effort. Yeah. And this, you know, to do it skillfully, to push a little, but not to break anything. Yeah. Like, you know, sitting through pain, sit, you know, 3-4 hours, 5-6. But watch your knee. If you stand up and, you know, after a few minutes walking around, it doesn't hurt anymore, then you understand that the pain is just, you know, something the mind brings up to move you. But you stand up and then the knee still hurts for an hour later, then there's something that you don't want to do it again. Yeah. So this ability just to test the mind, just what somebody does, test the body. Yeah. And we can sit for much longer than we think. Some of you are sitting, it feels like your leg is going to drop off when you get up, literally. That your body is going to be so much pain that you need surgery. And then you get up and you walk around and it's fine. And you realize, yeah, okay, the body is much more flexible, much more adaptable than we give it credit for. It's just the mental aspect of it. So the main thing is in training the mind. The physical pain is very little. The mental pain, that I don't want it, I'm not going to endure it, so much stronger. Then once you learn to let go of that, to work with that mental pain, when you are experiencing sickness, pain in the body, death, it's not a problem because you deal with it. But you haven't, and when the body starts to break down, then there's a lot of suffering to come from it, unnecessarily. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes?
Would you use that same attitude towards physical work, hard physical work, like block breaking, cold showers, discomfort, no central heating, no air conditioning, that kind of...
We do.
Beat myself with a stick.
Not for no reason. You don't beat yourself for no reason. But yeah, encourage people, like, you know, after a shower, have the hot shower, turn the hot water up and stay underneath for a couple of minutes. It's not going to kill you. Yeah. And the monastery as well, we encourage people to be comfortable, but not overly comfortable. Because it does make you a bit more flabby mentally. Yeah. So we do. Bodhinyana is very well provided, so things can be a bit too comfortable. But in other monastery, things are very austere, not out of kind of irritation or meanness, but just that training of keeps you a bit more sharp, a lot more physical work, wood chopping, and the heating is just enough to take the chill out, but not so warm that you fall asleep in a nice dhamma hall. Yeah. So it is this kind of, it's always a balance. If things are too comfortable, then you get lulled into a sense of kind of, you know, become more flabby and expect more comfort. And the end result is that, you know, is it improving your meditation? Yeah. Is it, being too comfortable? Not always. You think, oh, you know, if I had the air con on in the summer, my meditation would be better. Or if I get the heating, meditation would be better. Sometimes, not always. Sometimes a bit of, you know, coolness, you know, keeps you a bit more awake, aware. So it's true. Yeah, a bit of physical work as well brings up more resilience. Yeah, more sharpness in the mind. Questions or comments? Okay. With that in mind, we're going to continue sitting, walking to midnight. After not, you can do that, or you can. Try out, experiment with lying down meditation. Yes, like flat down meditation, Asher Brown says.